Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I will be talking about the possibility of extracting the so-called zero-point energy, or vacuum energy. As I go along, I'll explain exactly what that means, and we'll see how it can be applied. As we know, there is increasing interest because of problems with pollution from fossil fuels, problems with radioactivity from nuclear fuels, and therefore in all countries there's been an increasing interest in new approaches. Here are a list of some of them that I'm sure you're all familiar with. Solar energy, of course, does provide, quote, free energy in the sense that we don't pay for it. Unfortunately, it still has a problem with being expensive and not cost-effective to make the photoelectric devices, so that's why it has not had much of a market impact. Thermonuclear fusion, we have a joke in the United States that thermonuclear fusion looks good about 15 years down the road, but then it's always looked good about 15 years down the road. Some of these other things are coming along. Cold fusion, for example. The possibility of having apparent fusion reactions not at thermonuclear temperatures but in ordinary room temperature devices. This is something which I'm sure you've all seen in the newspapers. There was a lot of publicity when it was first announced, and then the media turned against it and declared it not viable because I think they hyped it too much to start. But in truth, work continues, and there are a number of laboratories in the United States and elsewhere that are continuing to explore this phenomenon and having some success. It may not be fusion, which is part of the problem in rejecting the phenomenon because it was not explainable in terms of fusion as usually understood. So I think we'll still see developments in that area as well. But the particular area I want to talk about today is so-called zero-point energy. What do I mean by zero-point energy? I'm actually talking about energy that physicists know of that's in ordinary empty space. Now, the whole concept of empty space and whether or not space is truly empty has gone back and forth over the centuries. The Greek philosopher Democritus argued that space, true empty space, must really be empty. Otherwise, how would the atoms have room to move around it? On the other hand, Aristotle came along and said, no, I don't think space is empty. Heat travels across space. Light travels across space. It must be traveling in some kind of medium. This went back and forth, and last century, Maxwell codified this concept when he recognized that electromagnetism propagated in the form of waves. And he said, well, water waves propagate in water, so electromagnetic waves must propagate in something. And therefore, he codified all the previous concepts with the idea that there was an ether, which was the medium that electromagnetic waves and light propagated in. Once that concept was put forward, people, of course, wanted to try to measure the properties of this background medium, or ether. And so Michelson and Morley and others attempted to, for example, measure the velocity of movement through the ether, the velocity of the Earth through this background medium. But they were unable to do so, as it turns out. And so finally, in putting special relativity together, Einstein came up with a concept that, in fact, space really was empty. You couldn't measure properties of this ether, so maybe it didn't exist. That was in 1905. By 1915, Einstein himself then developed general relativity. In general relativity, he found that there was a space-time metric, so-called, that space could be distorted and warped. And after recognizing that space had all these properties, for for the technical people in the audience, 10 potentials. He finally recognized that space was hardly empty, and so Einstein reversed his opinion and decided that indeed space was not empty, but was some kind of plenum. So, in Einstein's work, he went from space being empty to being filled. Finally, though, what really established it, without any doubt, is quantum theory. In quantum theory, it became absolutely clear that so-called empty space is not empty at all, but is a seething sea of activity, with fields coming and going, particles being created and annihilated on a microscopic level. In other words, a lot of activity. But what is this activity in quantum theory? Let's take the case of a simple oscillator. For example, a child on a swing, or a mass on a spring. Classically, we know that, for example, with the child on a swing, you give him a push, he'll swing, and then he will finally come to rest. Quantum mechanically, though, this is not true. If you start something swinging, start an oscillator oscillating, yes, it will die down because there are always losses in the system. But quantum mechanically speaking, it does not die down all the way to zero. There's always some remaining activity or motion left. This is called the zero-point energy. It's called zero-point because even at temperature of absolute zero, where you freeze out most motions, this motion, this activity, still remains. So that's where the term zero-point comes from. It means at the zero-point of temperature. Now, in quantum theory, this remaining zero-point activity remains not only for mechanical oscillators, for physical systems, but also for fields. For example, if I have a microwave cavity, which is nothing more than just a metal box, and I put an antenna into that box and give it a pulse of electromagnetic energy, I will set up fields inside the cavity. And then if I remove the antenna, the fields will die out because of losses in the walls. They won't die out all the way to zero. They will die out to some minimal amount of energy. So not only mechanical systems, but fields have this property that they never quite go away, even at the absolute zero temperature. Well, it turns out that the universe itself is just a giant cavity. And therefore, in the universe as a giant cavity, every possible frequency, every possible direction of propagation, every possible wavelength, all have this associated zero-point energy. So that means that even here in this room, all possible fields that could exist, even if we turned off all the antennas and went into far outer space, we would find that there was this residual energy associated with every mode, every direction of propagation, every frequency. When you add it all up, even in this room, it's been calculated by Feynman, by Wheeler, by many physicists. This is not a fringe idea. This is standard mainstream physics. It's recognized that there's enough energy in a coffee cup to, for example, evaporate all the world's oceans, even in this room. That may seem hard to believe. And when the idea first came out from quantum theory, it was thought that maybe this is some kind of mistake. It was hard to believe that that much energy was really there. But it's very uniform, and it turns out that we only see effects of that energy when there are differences that are induced. And as we will see, this concept started out as being a spectacular idea, hard to believe, but as we learn more and more about physics, we see more and more consequences. And I will go through those consequences. And then, of course, the one we're interested in here today is the possibility of actually extracting that energy for use. Well, if there's that much energy, even in this room, where does it come from? We understand where this energy comes from. By the way, just to point out that this is really a mainstream concept. This was a paper published just this year by T.D. Lee. T.D. Lee is a Nobel Prize winner. He was key in the discovery of the violation of parity in particle physics. And he's been one of the foremost leaders in pointing out that the vacuum is a physical medium, and there is no reason why it can't be engineered. So this is a mainstream concept. Where does this energy come from? It turns out that every electron throughout the entire universe, all the way out to the limits of cosmological observation, are all jiggling around doing their quantum dance, their quantum motion. And since they jiggle around, they radiate. So every electron, every other particle as well, but mostly the effect is due to electrons, every electron is moving around and radiating at a quantum level. Any particular particle here is caught in the radiation field of all the other particles, so that causes it to jiggle. And then when it jiggles and wiggles, it also radiates back. And so the development, the generation of this energy is very similar to taking the microphone, putting it near a speaker, and getting a squeal. It's just a giant feedback system. All the particles generate the energy, all in the form of radiation. The radiation causes the particles to jiggle, and they feed each other. When you carry through with that, you find out that you do, in fact, come up with an explanation of exactly how much energy there is in every frequency interval. I published on this myself about 5 years ago, Source of Vacuum Electromagnetic Zero-Point Energy. This is published in Physical Review A. Those of you who are familiar with the physics literature know that publishing Physical Review is difficult. It's one of the toughest of the peer-reviewed journals. So again, I want to emphasize that this is a mainstream concept. Anyone who wants to get the reference later in more detail can get it from me. By the way, in reference to the question that was asked here earlier about the frequency components, the frequency distribution of the vacuum zero-point energy goes as a cube of the frequency. So there is more and more energy at higher and higher frequencies, and there is energy at every frequency. And we know that it goes all the way up to the Planck frequency, 10 to the 44th hertz, or wavelength of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So it's a very broadband, blue noise type spectrum.
Could you repeat the range of the frequencies?
The range of frequencies is all the way from 0 hertz to 10 to the 44 hertz, way beyond anything we can measure. But it does show up in gravitational theories as a boundary condition. Well, as I mentioned, originally when physicists came up with zero-point energy as a concept, they did not discover it in the laboratory experimentally. It came out of the theory. And so it was thought, well, maybe it's an artifact of the theory. And so it was ignored for a while. Then when people developed Schrodinger's equation in quantum theory, they made calculations that if you excite hydrogen gas and you look at the light and the emission that comes out of hydrogen gas that's been excited, example, by an electrical discharge, you could calculate the frequencies of the light you would expect. But when you go in the laboratory and measure the frequencies, they're off by about a gigahertz. In other words, theory and experiment didn't match. And so it was recognized by physicists at the time that simply solving Schrodinger's equation, you were solving as if the atom were in a void. But the atom isn't in a void. It's in this seething cauldron of zero-point energy. So they went back and redid the calculation and found that if you took into account the fact that the zero-point energy was real, you then were able to find that experiment and theory matched. That effect is called the Lamb shift, and Lamb got the Nobel Prize for discovering that vacuum energy really did have an effect on atomic spectrum. That was back around 1948 that he did that experiment. So at that point, it was finally realized, okay, this isn't an artifact of the theory, it's real. But it's not very significant. It only has small-scale correction factors in atomic theory. But as time has gone on, we have found effects due to the zero-point energy that become more and more central to the rest of physics. And I'll describe some of those. For example, I don't know how many of you stay up at night worrying about why electrons don't, or why atoms don't collapse. It's not a burning issue for most people. But actually for physicists, for a while, it was a burning issue. You know, we have this model you see in textbooks of an atom sort of looking like a little solar system with the electron planets circling the nuclear sun. Well, to a physicist, he looks at that and says, why don't these electrons radiate their energy away? I mean, that's how we generate radio waves in radio antennas. We wiggle electrons. Well, you have these electrons wiggling around the atom, around the nucleus. Why don't they radiate their energy away? Well, at the time, Bohr, who came up with this basic planetary model, said, well, it's just the magic of quantum theory. It doesn't obey classical physics. It's not a very satisfying answer. We went on to develop Schrodinger's equation, quantum theory in great detail, but never actually answered that question of, well, why don't they electrons radiate the energy away, spiral into the nucleus like a satellite spiraling into the Earth, and all the atoms collapse? Well, as it turns out, as you might have guessed, it's the zero-point energy that keeps atoms from collapsing. If you assume that, in fact, the electron, as it rotates around the nucleus, does radiate its energy away, just as expected by classical theory, but then you take into account how much energy is absorbed from the vacuum fluctuations, you find that there is one stable orbit where the energy being radiated is just replaced by what's being absorbed from the vacuum fluctuations. And it turns out that is the known ground state orbit of the hydrogen atom. This can be extended to show that, in fact, the quantum ground states of all quantum systems are actually states in which the absorption from the background fluctuations and the re-emission are just balanced. I published this in Physical Review D back in 1987, ground state of hydrogen as a zero-point fluctuation determined state. So in fact, the only reason we're sitting in this room and that our atoms aren't collapsing is the fact that that background energy is there sustaining everything. So it's becoming more and more important. If someone could pull the plug on the vacuum fluctuation energy, everything would collapse and disappear. Another phenomenon which is now understood to depend on the vacuum energy is so-called spontaneous emission. The only reason we can see each other in this room, we have photons going back and forth that we pick up on the retina. Atoms absorb this photon energy, transitions occur. We see each other because of light being absorbed by atoms, and then it turns out they don't. That energy doesn't stay absorbed in the atoms. The atoms collapse back down and emit that energy in another form. This is so-called spontaneous emission. you have an atom sitting in empty space, it absorbs light photon, it becomes excited, it goes into an excited state with the extra energy from the light photon. While there, it's something like a pencil standing on its point. After a certain period of time, it falls over. That period of time can be measured, and that's the spontaneous emission time. It may be a millisecond, it may be a microsecond, it may be a second. But when an atom absorbs light energy, it will not stay in that excited state forever. It will collapse back down and give off that energy. It was for many years called spontaneous emission because it seemed like there was no mechanism to cause that collapse. But in fact, a couple of decades ago, it was suddenly realized that spontaneous emission is not spontaneous at all. It's actually triggered by the vacuum fluctuations. When that atom is in the excited state, it's the vacuum fluctuations that cause it to fall over, so to speak, and emit its photon. When that idea was first proposed, it was thought to be very controversial because up till then, it had been assumed that atoms work fine all by themselves. They don't need vacuum fluctuations to help them do their job. But the way the thing was tested was you could build a special cavity in which you eliminated the frequencies of the vacuum fluctuations. If you eliminated the vacuum fluctuations at those frequencies, then you eliminated the vacuum energy in those frequencies. If you eliminate the vacuum energy in those frequencies, and that's what was responsible for the spontaneous emission to occur, then in fact the atom should not spontaneously emit. And that's just what they found. By putting atoms that ordinarily would emit in some short period of time into special cavities, you're able to completely inhibit spontaneous emission. As of the latest review, it's been possible to lengthen the time that atoms are in excited state by factors of 50. You can also make special cavities to speed it up by factors of 500. And all of this because the vacuum fluctuations are there. Again, this may seem like maybe a fringe idea or something, but it's not. It's even reached the level of the popular Scientific American in an article last year, April 1993, where it talks about this phenomenon. The key phrase is, an excited atom that would ordinarily emit a photon cannot do so in one of these cavities because there are no vacuum fluctuations to stimulate its emission. So we're beginning to see that far from being a remote concept, it's a very central concept. Still, all of us would like to say, if there's all that energy in this room, why can't I feel it? Why can't I notice it? Well, in fact, you can. Simple experiment. We do it every day and probably don't think about it. It's possible for you to tell that that energy is really here in this room. Take the case that you get on a train or a bus and it suddenly takes off with a jerk. You can fall flat on the floor. You need to ask yourself, what was that force that knocked me down? Call it inertia, but of course giving it a label doesn't do anything. I mean, this is a very physical phenomenon. I'm standing on the bus takes off, I'm flat on my back, something knocked me down. What was it? What it was that you simply ran into the wall of vacuum fluctuations and they knocked you down. It's like a wind or a drag force. When you're in an airplane, the airplane takes off. You're in a Porsche takes off. I guess I should say Volvo takes off. You're pressed back in your seat, It's actually the vacuum fluctuations that are pressing you back. The phenomenon of inertia is a phenomenon which depends on the fact that there's all that energy in empty space. Why does Newton's law say you have to apply a force to get an acceleration? Why is force equals mass times acceleration? You have to apply a force to accelerate a body because you have to overcome the drag force due to the vacuum fluctuations. When you're moving at constant velocity, there is no drag force. So in that sense, it's not like the wind. If you move through the air at constant velocity, you feel the wind. Well, it turns out that in the vacuum fluctuation case, you don't feel that at constant velocity, the various effects cancel out. But if you try to accelerate through the vacuum fluctuations, you feel a drag force is proportional to the acceleration. This was just published by colleagues of mine and myself this year, in February 1994. Inertia as a zero-point field Lorentz force. I collaborated with people from Lockheed Aerospace Corporation and from California State University in Long Beach, and we showed that in fact inertia is this effect due to vacuum fluctuations. Earlier on I published a paper on Sakharov's model of gravity, the well-known Russian physicist, and in that paper we're able to show something similar to what Professor Niebuhr was talking about, that gravitation can be seen as an effect due to shielding of the background fluctuations. In that paper, an expression for gravitational mass was derived. In this paper, we derived an expression for the inertial mass, only having vacuum fluctuations as the basic concept, and the two agreed, as they must. We know empirically that inertial mass and gravitational mass have the same value, but it was never known why. And it turns out that it's because they both derive from vacuum fluctuation phenomena. Perhaps, though, the phenomena that most demonstrated that the vacuum effects were absolutely real, the vacuum fluctuations really exist, is the so-called Casimir effect. Casimir was the leading director of research at Philips Laboratory in the Netherlands. And back in 1948, he was investigating vacuum fluctuations, and he noticed a phenomenon, theoretically, which was then measured empirically, experimentally. It is exactly what you would expect if you believe the vacuum fluctuations are ordinary electromagnetic waves throughout space. As you know, if you have a transistor radio, you take it inside of a car or inside of a metal building, you won't be able to hear the radio station. The reason is that the metal container shields out the electromagnetic waves. So Casimir reasoned that if I take two pieces of metal and put them very close together, they should shield out some of this electromagnetic spectrum. After all, these vacuum fluctuation waves are, in fact, ordinary electromagnetic waves. Very low energy in any given frequency, but lots of energy when you take into account all the frequencies. So if I put two of these very close together, the interior region will be somewhat shielded. Well, electromagnetic waves, as solar radiation or whatever, they have energy, they have momentum. So the waves in between the plates are bouncing back and forth, pushing the plates apart. The waves outside the plates are bouncing off the plates and pushing the plates together. Since the interior region somewhat shields the interior space from this radiation, there's not as much radiation inside pushing them apart as there is outside pushing them together. and therefore plates will get pushed together by this vacuum energy. So if you went into far outer space, put up two metal plates, walk away, and wait, you'll see these plates will get pushed together by so-called empty space. When you do the calculation and compare it against the theory, it's absolutely clear that it is this vacuum fluctuation spectrum. The force that pushes these plates together goes as 1 over the 4th power, and so when the plates get very close, the force is very strong. It's been measured now up to 1,000,000 newtons per square meter. Well, a newton is about the weight of a book. A square meter is just that much. So this is a big force. There are certain industrial applications where you do electron beam machining and bring electron beam points down close to metal surfaces, and this force will actually pull them together. Anyone who's ever worked in a laser lab or in a machine shop and has put optical flats together or highly polished pieces of metal together, you know you can't pull them apart, you have to wring them apart. Well, that's partly because these vacuum fluctuation forces are pushing them together. This is a paper published a few years ago by researchers at Los Alamos. The only thing important about this, because I realize you can't see it, is the title. Radiation Pressure from the Vacuum. Physical Interpretation of the Casimir Force. So I'm giving all these examples to show that every way you look at it, this is a very real phenomenon, first. And secondly, it's very well understood. And third, it's definitely mainstream. What does this have to do with energy conversion? Hopefully I've convinced you at this point there's a lot of energy there. Can we get at it? Can we tap it? Can we extract it? Originally, after physicists recognized the energy was there, the question as to whether you could extract it came up, and most physicists thought, probably not. After all, we know there's a lot of heat energy in this room, but you can prove there's no way to extract it usefully. It takes more energy to extract the heat energy than you actually get when you extract it. And so the universal heat is not a useful source of energy. When it's recognized that there was this vacuum fluctuation energy, when people first thought about it superficially, they thought it was probably the same situation. You probably could not extract this energy usefully. However, not so. Let's take a look at the Casimir effect again and go through step by step very carefully, and you will see that this is a phenomenon which has been measured in the laboratory which already demonstrates that you can extract this energy. Put up two plates, walk away. The plates get pushed together. As they get pushed together, they squeeze out and shield more and more of the modes in the interior space. Where does the energy in those modes go to? It goes into the kinetic energy of the plates moving toward each other faster and faster. As it squeezes down more and more, there's more shielding, more modes can't fit inside there. That energy goes into the kinetic energy of the plates, and being attracted by this 1 over 4th power force, by the time the plates hit, they can be moving fast, and then that generates heat. So there you have a demonstration that in this effect, simply by putting up a couple of plates, it doesn't take any energy to do if you put them up far apart, walking away and waiting, eventually those plates will come together and generate heat. Some of the vacuum fluctuation energy will have been turned into heat. And you didn't pay a price for that. It was free with you. This was pointed out by a researcher at Hughes Laboratories in the United States. Hughes is an aerospace corporation. When that was first pointed out, back when you first say to a physicist, did you know you can extract energy from the vacuum fluctuations? They will say, no, I don't think so. Then you go through this argument. They say, okay, I understand why the energetics is there. You're not violating conservation of energy. You're just transforming one form of energy into another. But you're getting heat out of the vacuum, which is at temperature equals zero. How can you get heat out of a background that has no heat? There must be something wrong with the thermodynamics. Even though the energetics are there, maybe something is wrong with the thermodynamics. So I collaborated with a colleague from IBM, and we took a careful look at both the energetics and the thermodynamics and published a paper last year called Extracting Energy and Heat from the Vacuum. And we showed that not only was there no violation of conservation of energy, there was no violation of thermodynamic constraints. This is a completely viable concept. It does not violate any known physics. Okay. How can we extract this energy? Well, I could put plates up, let them come together. If I kept doing that, I'd generate lots of energy. But there's a problem there. I let the plates come together and I get my little burst of energy. What do I do next? Pull them apart? If I pull them apart, I've got to put as much energy in as I got out. So that doesn't work. So I can't let them come together and then pull them apart. Okay. What could I do? Well, I could have a friend of mine over here who just kept giving me plates. I'd let them go together. I wouldn't recycle them. I'd throw them away, take the next pair of plates, go together, throw it away. That would work in principle, but again, it's not practical because obviously it takes more energy to make those plates than I'm going to get out when they come together. Are there any practical ways? Well, there are three ways that have been looked at, listed here, and I will discuss all three today. The first one is not practical. The second two appear, they may very well be practical. Let's take a look at the first one, electromechanical, charge plate collapse. This was a paper published, I mentioned a few minutes ago, from Hughes Laboratories, Aerospace Corporation in California. The only thing of importance here is the title, Extracting Electrical Energy from the Vacuum by Cohesion of Charged Foliated Conductors. To those who, for whom English is not their first language, the cohesion of charged foliated conductors may not say much. Actually, it doesn't say much to people who speak English either. What he meant by that was, instead of having plates come together, you would simply make what in the United States we would call a slinky, which is a toy. And his idea was, instead of letting something collapse together and generating heat, let's make this accordion structure, charge it up, and let it collapse down. As it collapses down, it generates large electric fields as the charge gets more condensed. And then you could use those electric fields to drive current through a battery. In fact, he applied for a patent called a vacuum fluctuation battery. Again, you have this problem that once it's together, you've got a welded piece of metal. What do you do next? But you could conceive of going into outer space, making one of these miles across, letting it slowly come together and generate energy for you. It demonstrates the principle, but it's not really practical. Is there a practical way of doing this, though? Because the concept is neat. You've got charge concentrated into a small space, generate strong electric fields, and then use that energy. Again, if someone made a whole barrel of these and I could keep using them and throwing them away, I would do just fine. Well, is there a way of doing that that's practical? The answer turns out yes. Is to use a plasma pinch phenomenon in which you use this Casimir effect to pinch a plasma. Make an arc discharge, pinch a plasma. There we can have the equivalent of someone supplying me with barrels of devices and throwing them away. You can make plasma, let it get pinched, throw it away. Make some more plasma. An arc discharge, let it get pinched, throw it away. This is the main approach that we've used in our laboratory. Well, is there any laboratory evidence that under conditions that you could calculate using the theory, that you can, in fact, come up with charge that gets pinched and condensed and then generates energy that you can't account for, that therefore must have come from the vacuum fluctuations? It turns out the answer is yes. After we did the calculations some years ago, we realized that this effect should have been seen already in the charged particle beam weapons work. You know, in the United States, the Air Force was working on Star Wars, so-called, generating giant electron beams, hoping to shoot missiles out of the sky. And we looked at the calculations for the amount of electron density. We said, well, they should have seen this phenomenon already. And so we went to them and said, even though ordinarily when you make a beam of electrons, you might expect them to sort of fly apart by Coulomb repulsion, do you have any evidence that when you reach a certain critical threshold, that these electrons actually get pinched together? And they said, yes. How did you know? When we shoot off our big beams, most of the electrons land in spots where the density of the current, density of the electrons in those spots, is some 1,000 to 10,000 times greater than the average density, and this is an anomalous phenomenon. We can't explain it. That's what it looks like on titanium foil where these beams hit. Scanning electron microscope picture, optical microscope picture, and you see these pock marks where they hit. And they were not explained. We recognized from our calculations that this was probably the Casimir pinch effect. So at that point, we decided to set up a whole series of studies in our own laboratory. And as you'll see, we've had success in these experiments. So I think at this point we'll have our coffee break, and then we'll come back and look at the hardcore data and its implications. Thank you. You on now? Okay. As I mentioned, it would be nice if we could charge up plates, let them come together, throw them away, and so on. Well, that's not practical, but a plasma equivalent is practical. Our basic experiment is basically a high-technology version of scraping your foot on the rug and touching the doorknob and getting a little spark. What we have is a pointed cathode. It might be made out of titanium, copper, mercury-wetted copper, and then some kind of insulator such as ceramic, polyamide plastic, and then another conductor, for example, a molybdenum coating on the other side of the ceramic. And then we put a few kilovolts between one electrode and the other and just get a little lightning discharge. It's exactly as I say. It's like scraping your foot on the rug and touching the doorknob, getting a little spark. These micro-arc discharges are discharges that are microns, which is a millionth of a meter in diameter, typically involving kilovolts, amps to hundreds of amps in those little discharges, come in the form of pulses, nanoseconds, billionth of a second in length, microjoules of energy per pulse, but the most important part is this last term, discrete charge clusters. We find evidence that under certain threshold conditions, this Casimir effect comes into play and squishes the electrons down into a little ball. These are generated always under field emission conditions, so we have a very high field that draws electrons out of a point. They can be generated in gases along ceramic or plastic surfaces or in hard vacuum. A typical apparatus may look like this. You have a high voltage power supply. You have capacitors that get charged. Here we have a specific three-layer capacitor called Blue Line Discharger, which permits you to get very rapid rise time pulses. In this case, I've shown a pool of mercury as a cathode, and then it runs along a dielectric quartz, in this case, underneath a metal target. You don't have to worry about the electrons dropping off. They're attracted upward by image charge forces, and then they land. We're more than glad to share all this data because it's all patented. We're protected. Here's a typical device that you might see in one of our laboratory experiments. This is about a foot long. Here we have a copper electrode, mercury wetted on the tip. The brown you see here is a polyamide plastic, which is just 2 or 3 mils thick, but it will withstand kilovolts. And then copper anode down here. The entire setup can be in vacuum or have special gases put in. When you fire it off under normal conditions, you get emission from the cathode and you just generate a blurry arc discharge, not that much different from any fluorescent tube or a neon tube, for example. But if you meet the threshold condition for this Casimir condensation collapse, what you find is that a certain percentage of the electron flow will not just be the general discharge, but will actually form into a small ball of charge. And then when it hits the anode, you see this bright flash that you see at this point right here. Here's a case where we had several balls of charge in one discharge. If you look at what the material looks like where it lands, you see that instead of just generally having an electron flow that distributes itself over the surface, instead you get these 25 micron spots and 1 micron size spots. It turns out that if you even look at lightning discharge strokes, you find evidence for the same thing. We obtained a piece of a propeller from an airplane that had been struck by lightning. put it in a scanning electron microscope and saw evidence for this condensation effect, even ordinary lightning discharges. If we look at this in more detail, we find that those larger circles are really circles of small balls. So apparently, not only does the Casimir effect cause individual charge condensation into these structures, but they're even held together. And if there are any extra discharge components, they tend to be inside of the circle instead of outside. So everywhere we look, we see evidence that when you reach the threshold conditions that we calculate for this Casimir charge condensation effect to occur, you do, in fact, in the laboratory, see charge condensation effects. We've been studying these for 14 years. So this is not just something we saw a few days ago in the laboratory. We've generated a tremendous amount of data. In fact, I might mention this has led, totally independent of energy, this has led to a whole technology for which we have 17 patents called condensed charge technology. As you know, in electron devices in general, charge carrier densities typically are only can reach a certain value, and that limits the currents, voltages, signal strengths, and power levels. But if you make devices based on this condensed charge technology, it's like having giant electrons available to do ordinary electronics. And there are many applications that we've looked at that can be made using this condensed charge technology electronics. But of course, the one we're interested in here today is the energy conversion process. But still, I'll give you a chance to see one particular application, which was a medical X-ray application. You can generate these balls of charge, send them down the channel, and make X-rays. Now, it turns out that since these balls of charge are these little 1-micron-sized balls, and you might have 25-micron-sized circles of balls, that's so small that you can make an entire X-ray device inside a hypodermic needle. And so if someone has an interior tumor, instead of using high-voltage X-rays from the outside that burn the skin and flesh on the way to the tumor, you could take the hypodermic needle, inject it into the tumor, and just irradiate locally with lower energy X-rays. That's one application. These have actually been built. In fact, when we first developed this technology, we went to a medical X-ray company and asked them to build a device using this kind of technology. There's a paper clip to give you an idea of size. This is the pointed electrode. The white piece is the ceramic. And then behind that is the stainless steel anode. And when that's fired off, you're able to generate X-rays, and in this case, we made a picture of an X-ray of a copper screen mesh made with the X-rays. So this technology has actual applications that are real world, independent of the energy application. As I mentioned, we have, I think, 17 different devices and 7 separate patents on various applications. Let's get back to the energy. I've shown you some evidence for anomalous charge concentration, which comes from this Casimir pinch effect. Now the question is there evidence that in fact, as predicted by theory, these balls of charge have extra energy there than what we put in? Because remember, the theory says that if we make a discharge, we have to put a certain amount of energy in, but if we get to a certain point where the vacuum then puts the rest of the energy in, when it contracts the electrons down into a little ball, you then have an enormous electric field around these balls of charge, full of energy, and energy that we did not have to pay a price for. It came from the vacuum. One of the first devices we built was a tiny traveling wave tube. Traveling wave tubes are a standard microwave component used in microwave communication, satellite communication. Typically, the way a traveling wave tube works is you send a beam of electrons down a tube, you put some signal on that beam, and as it's going down the tube, it induces a voltage in a spiral helix around the tube, and you get an amplified signal into a load at the end of the tube. Well, in our case, we didn't put a signal in to be amplified. We just simply made these charge balls by this Casimir condensation effect, shot them down the helix, and then measured the output power as compared to the input power. Output energy is compared to the input energy. It's a very tricky experiment to do. This is a very small device. And we got an order of magnitude more energy out than we put in, which we felt showed the effect that we were looking at. I might say, if that's the case, then why aren't I running my house or running my car on this? It turns out it's a very difficult experiment to do. It only works for a few seconds at a time. For reasons we understand, the tube tends to get charged up. You have to wait until the charge dissipates before you can do it again. You have to get the vacuum pressure just right. In this case, we had xenon gas in the tube. And as the gas pressure came up, it would hit a regime where it would work for a while, and then it would stop working. We'd have to pump it down. As the pressure dropped, it would work for a while and then quit working, and just a very tricky kind of thing to do. So it turned out that this was great for demonstrating the effect as a laboratory phenomenon, but it was not easy to engineer this into something useful. We took a look at another phenomenon, which, according to our calculations, when we make these balls of charge by this vacuum condensation effect, there should be so much field strength in those balls of charge that you ought to be able to shoot it through ceramic, which is a very hard material, and just bore holes through it as if it were a hot knife and butter. We set up an experiment to do that, and in fact, that's exactly what we observed. This is a piece of ceramic which we've split apart so you can see the tracks. One of these cathode devices off of which field emission occurs and forms these balls was stuck down into a piece of ceramic, and we fired pow, 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 pow at about that rate, and it just bored holes through the ceramic as if the ceramic were not there. Look very carefully at one of those paths, and it's clear that it just simply vaporized the ceramic. The ceramic's that tough material you put inside of high temperature ovens, for example. It's very tough material. And so again, we had what we felt was good demonstrative evidence that these balls of charge had a tremendous amount of energy. Again, it was possible in this case to calculate how much energy does it take to vaporize that much ceramic compared to how much energy we put in. And again, it was a factor of about 10. In other words, 10 times more energy out vaporizing the ceramic than we put in, which is what you would expect from the standpoint of this Casimir charge condensation effect. We spent a lot of time in very elaborate laboratory setups to make detailed measurements. This is a typical setup where we have something called a calorimeter. which is basically a box that measures the total heat content coming out of an experiment. So we take one of our experiments and we put it in the box, and whatever energy is generated comes out and the calorimeter measures it. And we have complete computer control and measurement of the energy going into the experiment. So if we drive our experiment with electrical signals, we can measure exactly how much energy we're putting in. We measure how much total energy comes out, turned into heat in the box, and we have a very fundamental measurement of our input and our output. Anyone involved in cold fusion work knows how tricky doing good calorimetry is. I mean, we spent 2 years and about $100,000 just getting the measurement system set up so it works accurately. Inside the blue box, this is a typical experiment where we have a switch that switches the signals into the device. The device in this case was located there. This is a capacitor that's charged to drive the device, and we make measurements of total electrical energy in, total heat energy out. Of course, in an actual application, we want to go back and do the traveling wave tube design scaled up, because you'd like to have electrical energy in and more electrical energy out rather than generating heat. Because for many applications, heat is not the best output energy. But for measurement in the laboratory and learning about the phenomena, turning your final output energy into heat and measuring it very accurately is the best way to get good data. So an experiment that can typically be run in the calorimetry mode is to put in a certain amount of electrical energy, let's say 200 milliwatts, and over a couple of hours or a few hours, you get a certain measurement of output energy. You then turn off the calibration, put the same 200 milliwatts into the experiment, and the experiment is creating the condensed charge effect. And again, measure the output. And the output under that condition, even though you're putting in 200 milliwatts, comes out to be more than the 200 milliwatts you're putting in. And in order to check that something just hasn't gone wrong with calorimetry, you turn off the experiment, turn the calibration back on, and it drops back down to the calibration level. So we do dozens and dozens of these experiments, changing parameters, carefully getting a fix on what current should we use, what voltage should we use, what material should we use. I mean, this is very tedious, non-glamorous work. To give you an idea, I'll show you three view graphs about it. The chambers include water, various electrodes and air, commercial glow discharge chambers, gas vacuum chambers, the materials to be used in the cathodes in the experiment, maybe copper, brass, stainless steel, tungsten, carbon. Gases can be air, various gases at different pressures. The charging capacitors can be anywhere from picofarads to nanofarads. You change inductance in the circuit to shape the pulsing. Different kinds of loads for transforming the energy into output, different levels of discharge, voltages, currents, supply energies, powers. And so it just takes a long time, years really, although we're hoping to cut it down, to work through these various parameters to see which is the most efficient. This is something you can't calculate in advance. This is very nonlinear phenomena. It's very catastrophic, abrupt phenomena. All you can do is play in the lab and see what works best. There's really no way of trying to determine in advance what's going to be the best. Now, for the skeptics in the crowd, it may still seem that somehow this is something for nothing, free lunch, something must be wrong. So for those people, I like to make the comparison of what we're talking about here with nuclear fusion. If you believe that nuclear fusion can occur, then you have to believe that this phenomenon can also be used. Because essentially, the energetics are the same. What do you do in nuclear fusion? You create some kind of dense plasma to overcome the Coulomb barrier and force the nucleons together. What do we do in this kind of experimentation? We create a dense plasma in an arc discharge to overcome the Coulomb barrier to reach a threshold condition, just as in nuclear fusion. What happens next in nuclear fusion? There's a short-range attractive force, a nuclear force, which compactifies further, don't pay a price for it, and it creates a new species, for example, hydrogen into helium. Similarly, in the phenomena we're talking about, there's a short-range attractive force, in this case, the Casimir force, also compactifies further that you don't pay a price for, creating a new species. It takes free electrons and forms them into charged clusters. Then what happens? During the final compactification in the nuclear case, in accordance with the law of conservation of energy, not against it, the potential energy of the attraction is converted into some other form, say particles of radiation. So similarly here, during the final compactification is the potential energy of a short-range attractive force, which in this case is the Casimir force, has to be converted into another form, for example, stored Coulomb energy. So the energetics of nuclear fusion and the energetics of what you might call electron or Casimir fusion are really identical. So, as with nuclear fusion, you're not getting something for free, you're just taking advantage of a natural process in nature. Similarly, in the case of the electron fusion by the Casimir effect, you're just simply taking advantage of an effect that exists in nature. Now you might think, though, that nonetheless, this is such an outrageous idea, the patent office would never go for it. Sounds like perpetual motion or totally free energy or whatever. But it's not the case. We've been very successful in patenting. We now have 7 patents on this process that have been issued. And the key phrase in the patent, which the patent office agreed was permitted, was that energy is provided and the ultimate source of the energy appears to be the zero-point radiation of the vacuum continuum. So any of you who know the U.S. patent approach, they are death on cold fusion, they're death on perpetual motion machines, they're death on magic of any kind, but they felt that the process we were describing was not magic, it was real engineering, and the patents were provided. And so we've applied for patents all over the world. Anyone who's been into patenting knows an expensive process it is. I'm still $50,000 in arrears in my patent bill, but that's the way it goes. Now, in addition to this plasma pinch process, that generates energy from the vacuum, there's also another phenomenon, which may be related to some of the effort that Dr. Nieper was talking about. It's a phenomenon called sonoluminescence. This is an entirely different phenomenon, but also appears to produce excess energy from the vacuum fluctuations. Sonoluminescence is a phenomenon that occurs when you make turbulent fluids, which have bubbles in them, and then the bubbles collapse. So we're talking about an entirely new process. There's a lot of work going on in this field at UCLA, University of California in Los Angeles.
ultrasonic acoustic signals are put in to create turbulence in fluids. Or you can have rotors and fluids that are spinning like mad and creating turbulence. And of course, that will generate bubbles in the fluids. Well, it turns out that just as we've described that the vacuum pressure can force charge together, it turns out that the vacuum pressure is also involved in collapsing bubbles in fluids. In this case, although you don't have parallel metal plates, what you do have is a surrounding fluid that has some dielectric constant, and then you have a void where the dielectric constant is different. So just as the Casimir effect will push plates together, it will also push dielectrics together. More weakly, but it will still occur. And it will collapse bubbles. This is a paper published last year by Julian Schwinger. Schwinger is a Nobel Prize laureate in physics, got the Nobel Prize along with Richard Feynman. And he was studying this phenomena of bubble collapse. When the bubbles collapse, you get hundreds of thousands of photons in 50 picoseconds, 50 trillionths of a second. Enormous burst of light and heat. And Schwinger analyzed it and said, that energy coming out of this bubble collapse is due to vacuum fluctuation energy being converted. And he published this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States. I think this speaks directly to a well-known anomaly which has to do with cavitation around submarine propellers. As you can imagine, the navies of all countries have tried to analyze what happens in the turbulence of submarine propellers because it generates noise. And that noise can be picked up by signal receivers. And it's a problem that's never really been totally resolved. And one of the most provocative elements is that propellers generating the turbulence are literally melted. When you take a propeller off a submarine and look at it, the metal is actually being melted by this cavitation process. And every two or three years, a new group comes up with a new theory as to what is it about turbulence in fluids that's melting the propellers. And so far, no one has come up with an answer because the energy required is too much. And I think finally, in this kind of work, we know where the energy is coming from. It's coming from vacuum fluctuation energy involved in the bubble collapse. Now, we know of another laboratory that we're now cooperating with that makes something called a hydrosonic pump. This was an ordinary industrial company that decided to make boilers that give you hot water or steam, not on the basis of burning gas, but on the basis of having a rotor that generates turbulence. And they put 30 kilowatts in. And of course, as part of their industrial applications, they had to measure how much output power they were getting or how much they were driving it with. How efficient was this boiler? And as it turns out, for them, it was embarrassing, they got more output than they were putting in. And of course, that meant people who wanted to buy their boiler thought they didn't know how to make measurements. The input energy, with help from us, is being measured very accurately, both electrically and mechanically, so we know precisely how much energy is going into this pump. And you're getting about 5 kilowatts of extra energy out in this turbulent situation, or an efficiency of something on the order of 16% over unity. And this is measured in a very fundamental way because you get out steam or hot water. And it's very easy to make a heat measurement. We're now cooperating with this laboratory. As I'm here today, one of the big units has been shipped to our laboratory, and we're going to do exhaustive tests. But a number of other groups have already gone to this laboratory. My own engineers have gone to the laboratory, and we can't find anything wrong with their experiment. So it may be that this will turn out to be a very practical way of generating extra energy by this vacuum effect. Now, what are some of the implications of this? If I talk casually to a group like this, often people will say, well, if this is all true, the oil companies will buy it up and put it on the back shelf, or they will assassinate you. Some terrible thing will happen. Or the government will clamp down on you, or you'll never be able to do this, etc., etc. Well, I heard these stories. I tend not to be paranoid myself, but I want to check it out. So when we first had the effect in the laboratory, we didn't tell anybody, but I went to the president of Pennzoil. Since maybe these stories could be true, I didn't tell him we'd already done it. But I just told him that this is predicted in quantum physics. What would be the response of your corporation if this turns out to be true? I talked to the president or research directors of all of these oil companies about this phenomenon. The answer across the board was, we would welcome it. And the reason they gave me, I found to be believable. They said that when we pull oil out of the ground and make drugs or plastics, pharmaceuticals, nylons, we don't use up much of our resource and we have an enormous profit margin. But when we pull it out of the ground and dump it into cars or into people's homes for heating, it's sort of like heating your home by burning Van Goghs and Picassos. There's no profit margin and you're using up your resource at a rapid rate. So if some other industry would come along and take this burden off the fossil fuel industry, we would more than welcome it. In fact, we'd be the first to invest in it so that we could make our refineries more efficient. So I do not think that the prevailing myth that the oil companies would be against this is just not true. I don't think so. There's another thought that, well, with this kind of energy available, the government will try to stop it. Be used only for military purposes, etc. So early on in this work, I ended up briefing a number of agencies, Department of Defense, and so on in our own government. And again, we did not find any evidence that there would be an attempt to stop this. For example, I briefed the Assistant Secretary of Commerce in 1990 because they recognized that this kind of energy source, even third world countries could make. It wouldn't be that difficult. And what effect would that have on the world economy? And so that's why I ended up briefing there. In our country, the Department of Commerce also owns the National Bureau of Standards, or as it's now called, National Institutes of Standards and Technology. That institute has generally been the leader in putting down claims of unusual energy devices. Any of you are familiar with the development of a device by Joe Newman in our country. It was the National Bureau of Standards that showed that it didn't really work as he claimed. So we decided to brief them also to see what their response would be. And in their case, they looked at the technology, they looked at the theory, they said that this seems okay to us, and we have an agreement with them now, it's part of our business plan, that when we have a robust device, prototype, ready to go into the marketplace, we will take it to them for independent verification, and we will not make any announcement until they agree it actually works. The idea is to avoid the fiasco and the problems the coal fusion got into. We want to make sure that other laboratories replicate the effort before we would make any announcement. And then we'd all come out hand in hand, and then it would be a solidly established fact. So what would be the best way to develop this? We thought about development strategies. The first thing that has been told us by various advisors would be this would be very geopolitically destabilizing. Because even if the oil companies don't mind you developing this, because after all, they only operate at the refinery level, the people who own the oil in the ground in the Mideast will not like this, because there will not be as great a demand for oil. And so the strategy to try to handle that potential problem is that when you get up to the stage where you're ready to go into large-scale marketing, manufacturing marketing, you get investment from the people in the Mideast who generally make their money at this point from the oil. And so you say, this is coming along. You don't want to ride a dead horse down. Why don't you invest in this and help develop it? What about the nuclear industry? Wouldn't the nuclear industry be against the competition? I think the answer is no. The strategy with the nuclear industry was you go to the nuclear industry and say, you have a fine multi-billion dollar plant and distribution system here, but obviously you've got problems. You've got radioactivity, waste problems, you've got Greenpeace on your back, etc., etc. Tell you what, we have this new device. Why don't you pull out those nasty radioactive rods and throw them away, drop in our environmentally friendly rods. Then you go to your consumers and you say, we've gotten rid of radioactive problems and we're going to reduce your costs. And so that way you get the nuclear industry also not to throw away their plants, but to use their plants in an environmentally friendly way. And so instead of being an enemy, we think they will also be an ally. What about the electric power utilities? Well, a lot of people say, well, if we had these devices, let's just put them in the garage and everybody unplug. Of course, that would be economically destabilizing. But I don't think it's necessary to do that. There's continually increasing demand from the electric power industries. And so we would approach electric power industries and say, okay, when you have to meet that increasing demand, instead of doing it by buying more of the machines you're presently using, instead, use these zero-point energy units to meet the increasing demand. And since they have to satisfy the Clean Air Act requirements that are becoming stronger and stronger in our country, these new units will satisfy that because there are no known pollution or harmful byproducts as far as we can tell. And so again, you don't go up against an industry, you find a way to make that industry more helpful and more efficient. So we would propose actually skipping the generator in the garage stage. But what you do next is you'd go to individual manufacturers and say, okay, on your next line of refrigerators or TV sets or whatever, don't put a plug. Put one of these devices in the back. And so then slowly over a period of time, as various appliances became obsolete, they would be replaced by new appliances that had this built-in energy source. And so there wouldn't be a sudden catastrophic change. Besides, realistically, if we had units sitting on the table here now, ready to go into manufacture, it would still be decades before you could manufacture enough for every home. So this would be a reasonable way to do it. Manufacture smaller units, put them in individual devices. So you'd have your electric toothbrush with a never-say-die battery all the way up to power plants for aircraft carriers. Of course, there'd be special purpose, non-utility niches. As I say, never-say-die batteries for space applications, electric cars, We're already working with a group that's involved in building flywheels for electric cars, space propulsion. At this point, we don't see any reason in principle why you couldn't scale up to an arbitrary size, because the vacuum energy is everywhere. I mean, it's in outer space as well as in this room. So my salesman slide is this one. All businesses must have a sales slide. What's the problem with fossil fuels? Typically heat into electricity. Nuclear energy, heat into electricity. Assuming we can go back and do a lot of engineering with the traveling wave tube, we'd have direct electrical to electrical. In the fossil fuel and the nuclear energy case, you've got some kind of pollution byproduct. This appears to be pollution free. Again, in fossil fuels and nuclear energy, you do have a central plant which then distributes the energy. But this is intrinsically available locally anywhere, which is a nice feature. And then whereas in the fossil fuel case, you've got some countries have it, some countries don't, and that makes for geopolitical destabilization. In the nuclear case, you've got environmental and regulation uncertainties. None of that would appear to be a problem in this area. So what is the present status realistically? First, we can say that what we're talking about is scientifically sound. We have a proven laboratory phenomenon, the Casimir effect, which extracts the energy from vacuum fluctuations. As far as I know, no physicist who gets involved in taking a look at this feels that it isn't true. The Casimir effect is a well-known effect, studied for various implications in many areas of physics. It's an accepted fundamental concept. So it's not a pseudo-scientific idea, it's real science. It's certainly embryonic in its development. I didn't fly over here in a plane fueled by zero-point energy, so clearly this is not yet into the market or really even ready for the market. As you saw from my slides where we're trying all kinds of materials and parameters and so on, there's a lot of R&D yet to be done. When an investor comes and asks, can I invest in your project? Of course, we welcome that, but we tell them that it's high risk, but on the other hand, it's infinite payoff. So if you're willing to do high risk, infinite payoff investment, this is the way to go. If you want to put your meager savings into retirement, you do not want to invest in this. If you want to be a trillionaire in the year 2010 or something, maybe you would. So for workers in the field, we feel confident that just as the 20th century will probably go down as a nuclear age, we think the 21st century will go down as a zero-point energy age, as far as energy is concerned. Thank you very much, and I'm going to answer questions. To a foot. So the lifetime for the clusters in our case are nanoseconds. Maybe 20, 30, 50 nanoseconds, no more. What happens to them is that, as you may realize from this plates effect I'm describing, this effect is very dependent on boundary conditions. For example, plates will be pushed together. Wedges will be collapsed. Cylinders will be squeezed. But spheres that you might think would be squeezed, in the case of metal, are blown up. It just works out that way. Although it turns out that bubbles and fluids will be collapsed, spheres will be blown up. So it's very boundary dependent. So what happens to the charge clusters as they approach an anode? The boundary conditions of the anode are such that the container, if you will, for this effect becomes disrupted, and then the electrons blow up, so to speak, to become free electrons again. So basically, you make these charge clusters, they last a few nanoseconds, and then they blow up. Any more questions?
So my name is Bjorn Malmström. I have a question about the power generation. Do you see in the future the power generation with these devices as big scale in power companies, or mainly in small scales in small houses?
In principle, we see no reason why it couldn't be scaled from small to very large. These charge clusters are intrinsically small components, so it's pretty clear that it's going to be easier to make small devices
rather than large devices.
So I think in terms of going into the marketplace, you're more likely to find, let's say, zero-point energy batteries than zero-point energy equivalents of nuclear power plants. So it will start out small scale. In principle, provided the materials aspects can be dealt with, we don't see any fundamental reason, although there may be a lot of engineering difficulty, in making it larger and larger scale. At this point, there's so much research and development yet to be done, we really can't say with certainty.
Now, in the case of the
sun luminescence bubble collapse, if that continues to hold up, and it looks like it will, that's already at the kilowatt level. And so it may be that for larger scale devices, fluid turbulence effects will be more useful than arc discharge effects. We just don't know. He would think so because he's had access to data about turbulent fluid devices, and he thinks that may well be the way to go. Next question. Any questions?
Yes, I wonder how will an energy system that used to have an enormous abundance of power heat up the atmosphere in the long run? I mean, will somehow it has to be.
Well, it's certainly true that if we have more energy available and cheaply, we're going to use more energy.
Yeah.
And so the possibility of heating of the atmosphere and so on has to be taken seriously. So in the short run, you simply can't manufacture, even working day and night in 100 plants, you would not be able to manufacture enough units per year to equal one volcanic eruption or whatever. So for a while, I don't think it will be a problem. But eventually, there will probably have to be regulation. Because one of my worst nightmares is with free energy, Madison Avenue in New York City will cover the sky with neon advertising. On the other hand, it's also the case that with the development of this kind of energy, space exploration would become much easier. And so, there's obviously a big movement to use this energy off planet.
Okay, Hector, is Casimir effect and Schaumburg effect the same?
The Casimir effect and which effect?
Schaumburg effect. About the chambers.
I wondered about that because it may be. Similar to the sun luminescence, the bubble collapse phenomena, and I'm interested in hearing more about what Jens Tellefsen had to say about that. It's been reported, I don't know from personal experience, but it's been reported that in the Schauberger devices, when the water spirals down at a certain point, you get a blue flash. That blue flash may be an electrical arc discharge that takes place, which could be the discharge version. Or maybe sonoluminescence, because in these bubble collapse experiments, you also see bright blue light. And so, if it's either of those effects, then there would be a connection. I just don't know enough about the Schauberger effect, though, to know for sure.
Tremendous need for energy in the future will certainly be water desalination.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a demand for water worldwide, as you know, from water purification, that the need for energy for water conservation will just be abundant. And this is also a big, big economy income source for the industries of tomorrow. Water desalination,
yes.
Certainly foreseeable.
That's right. In fact, in the state of Texas, there are programs for water desalinization off water in the Gulf of Mexico, and it is part of our business plan that we get to a point where we have a prototype device. We may approach state authorities who are involved in desalinization projects for further funding to develop our devices. Very aware of the desalinization need.
Joseph Gruber, Hagen, Germany. I would like to congratulate Dr. Puthoff on his scientific achievements. I'm not a physicist, I'm an economist. I give the last talk tomorrow, and you will get a paper in which I say a little more about the economic effects of this new energy as I see it at the moment. Now, I think it is very difficult to put in the right perspective your lecture. I think your achievements, your scientific achievements, can contribute to a scientific revolution. I find it great. High esteem for your achievements and a lot of success in the future.
Thank you.
Now, I would like to voice one point on which I do not agree with you, namely to start and spend a lot of time on producing such little things like a toothbrush with such a new battery. So in my lecture tomorrow and the paper, which you can get 51 pages long, you find some figures for savings to individual German households if they use a car driven by a water-fueled engine. If you drive 15,000 kilometers per year, 8 liters of gasoline per 100 kilometers, and 1 mark and 50 pennies per liter, it means 1,800 marks, I think, per year. 1,800 marks. If I have a chance to save 1,800 marks per year by using such a new car, I will replace my cars, my present cars, Japanese cars, by the way, by such a new car, and I'm not satisfied with a toothbrush. If I can get a generator in my home for producing heat and electricity, I can save in my family and in similar families about 3,000 to 4,400 miles per year for electricity and natural gas from Russia for heating. By the way, I also have 8 solar collectors on the roof of my house, and it ran, this equipment just worked 1 year, and I harvested 6,600 kilowatt hours. That's not so bad. But still, I could save some 4,000 to 5,000 marks per year by using new energy. And so toothbrush is not enough. And now imagine what this means. What this means for the economy. If all consumers of all owners of a car want to have such new cars, say 10% every year, 10% of the cars every year will be replaced. This will have tremendous effects, and I do not know how to handle all these effects. Most of the effects are positive, but some effects are very negative. Especially, we will lose a lot of jobs. We will have many new jobs, very many new jobs. But I fear that more jobs are lost, more jobs become superfluous than we get new. And if we do not learn to share better with others, the total amount of work we need in an economy in the world, we will get tremendous problems. So, but more on this tomorrow. Thanks a lot, and again, congratulations.
And I promise not to start with electric toothbrushes.
My name is Peter Willem, and I would ask you if you have some, if you have any ideas about the propulsion of spacecraft in future, if there be any means to overcome the speed of light limits, or if we could possibly overcome the gravity effect mass gravity.
This carries a somewhat far afield, but in fact, the theory and technological concepts have been carried forward into the propulsion area. If you look at the details, you find that inertial and gravitational mass really just represents the energy associated with vacuum fluctuation jiggle. And it's possible to completely understand Einsteinian general relativity on the basis of vacuum fluctuation interactions, as Andrei Sakharov, the famous Russian physicist, was one of the first to point out. And once you get into engineering the vacuum, you can basically do whatever you want to do. I'll give you one example. You said, could you travel faster than the velocity of light? What is the velocity of light? C, we represent. C is, for an engineer, 1 over the square root of mu 0 epsilon 0, where that's the magnetic permeability and dielectric constant of the vacuum. By engineering the vacuum, you can change the values of those constants. So you can change the local velocity of light, in principle, in theory. And in fact, in studies in general relativity, there's already a lot of work on the concept of changing the vacuum constants. For the physicists, it's the so-called TH epsilon mu formulation of relativistic theories. And so if you look at that, it turns out that you could, in principle, engineer the vacuum so as to change the local light, and then you would, to an outside observer, exceed the velocity of light. You would not be violating special relativity because you would have actually changed the velocity of light locally, and you would still not be going faster than the local velocity of light. So the reason ordinarily we say you can't go faster than the velocity of light is that we have equations with denominators that 1 minus b squared over c squared. As the velocity approaches c, you're dividing by 0, you have infinite energy and infinite mass. But if you take the value of C, manipulate the vacuum constants so as to increase that by a factor of 100 or 10 or whatever, then without violating those constraints, you could, by manipulating local space, exceed, as looked at from the outside, the velocity of light. And these kinds of things are not fringe ideas. They're being examined by a number of physicists. In fact, on the airplane coming over, I just read another article along that line that had just recently been published about controlling the vacuum, generating space-time warps, and essentially doing whatever you want to do. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. As you may, as a physicist may understand, what I've been talking about, the vacuum fluctuations, there's a particle flip side to that, and that is that the vacuum is full of electron-positron virtual pairs. And those virtual pairs are what determine the dielectric constant of the vacuum and can, in principle, be manipulated. There's already a publication in the physics literature, you may not know this, that shows that between Casimir plates, where the vacuum energy density has been decreased, just like we've been talking about today, you can calculate that the velocity of light is higher than we ordinarily think it to be. That's already mainstream published in this.
Sorry, we are a little late, but here, last question for lunch.
It's my name is Sven Alfas. Can we ask, I first would like to say that I'm very happy to be here, to hear such excellent lecture. And I'm not so happy that you are leaving us to go back tomorrow. that, I would like to ask you, can you tell something about vacuum as a state of matter?
The vacuum as a state of matter. The vacuum appears to be a dielectric medium. Just like any crystal or any material is a dielectric medium, the vacuum is a dielectric medium. Now, we ordinarily talk about this coffee cup being a dielectric medium. By dielectric medium, we mean it has positive and negative charges, and they can oscillate back and forth. And in the coffee cup, it's electrons and protons. That's what oscillates around and forms a dielectric medium. In the vacuum, or so-called empty space, the plus and minus charge are what the quantum theorists would call the electron-positron virtual pairs. Even empty space looks like a sort of a matter medium, but it's called a virtual matter medium, because you have this continuous creation annihilation of electron-positron pairs. Since the electron has negative charge, positron has positive charge, the vacuum also looks like a dielectric medium. And when you think about it, when you get, for example, an electric field in the vacuum, what do you mean? You've got an electric field. Electric field points from positive to negative charge. Well, it's actually slight polarization of the vacuum is what electric fields are all about. So you want to think about the vacuum in terms of matter. Most of your intuition about what occurs in dielectric media can be carried over into what occurs in the vacuum. It's only that in the vacuum, it's the electron-positron pairs form the, quote, substance of the vacuum. If you want to go a step deeper, you can say, well, where are the electrons and positrons? Well, they're probably vortex motions of the original vacuum zero-point field energy. So we don't know where it stops.
Thank you very much, Dr. Putov. Very interesting and very fascinating lecture.
Thank you.